and perform a full and fair investigation of including using the FBI as the investigator. And the last thing for Congress, using its constitutional power to investigate the cover-up in this case, because it's obvious there was a cover-up. To suggest anything otherwise would mean that the Constitution would just be a nullity, and anyone could actually be killed at the hands of the government, and there's no one that would be held accountable.
And you, Valerie Carey, what do you hope these tort claims and lawsuits will accomplish?
I would just have to concur with what Eric just said. That's my hope as well.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for joining us. Is there anything else that you feel that you would like to add, either of you, to what you think that listeners should know?
Well, there's two things I want to mention. And, of course, in doing this whole thing, we like to thank at least, WND, which was very instrumental in writing probably about a good 70 or 80 articles about the Marion Carey case, as well as the pending litigation in the district court trying to force the release of all the documents and videos related to the Marion Carey shooting, along with Judicial Watch. So I'd definitely like to thank those two organizations.
Is there anything else that you would like to add, Valerie Carey?
No, thank you. Thank you for having us on your show to be able to bring some light and amplify my sister's voice.
Well, I want to thank you so much, and of course, my deepest condolences for your loss of your sister, Miriam Carey. Again, I have been speaking with Valerie Carey, the sister of the late Miriam Carey, who was killed in October of 2013 by Secret Service and Capitol Police in Washington, D.C., as well as Eric Sanders, the attorney with the Sanders firm, which has filed two federal tort claims against the government for willful violations of policies that resulted in the death of Miriam Carey. Thank you both so much for joining us today on KBOO.
Thank you for having us.
This is Jinka Soderberg with KBOO News.
And finally today on the radio scene, we hear an interview from the program The Scholar's Circle with journalist Heather Rogers, whose latest book is Green Gone Wrong, How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution, which takes a critical look at popular market-based solutions to ecological destruction. So you'll want to stay tuned after the radio zine for an afternoon from the Waterfront Blues Festival. So keep it right here on your community radio, KBOO.
Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Are some green solutions unhelpful for the environment, or worse, do they actually harm it? Over the past few years, more and more green solutions have emerged to address environmental crises. But our next guest says that some of these amount to lazy environmentalism and may have a dark side effect of camouflaging a larger problem. Heather Rogers argues that our current socioeconomic system depends on pollution to maintain its own well-being. And if so, what are the real solutions? Heather Rogers joins us now. She's a journalist and author of Green Gone Wrong, How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution. Welcome.
Thank you, Maria.
I want to actually start with this concept of lazy environmentalism.
Sure.
And what you mean by it.
Right. It's not a term that I coined. It's something that has some currency in the newer generation of environmentalism, which eschews the guilt, you know, and the sacrifice of the environmentalism that came up in the 1970s. It's the 40th anniversary of Earth Day, saying, okay, we don't have to suffer. We can live in nice houses and we can live well and we can drive where we want to drive in hybrid cars and enjoy ourselves. And we can use the market mechanisms in order to have a good life and save the planet. I don't know if that really works.
So you actually argue that you don't think it does at all and might even make it worse in some ways.
Well, what happens is the way that the market works is that it has to grow. And in order to do that, it has to utilize materials in nature. It can't stop extracting and affecting the natural environment, ecosystems that we need in order to hold back climate change, in order to keep our water clean and diverse species all over the planet. What I'm saying is that, you know, there's this fundamental logic that we can't undo by replacing green products for dirty ones. You know, that fundamental logic is still there, where wealth comes from.
It still comes from the ground and it still comes from nature. And I wonder if it's just a part of being human that we are exploiting nature. How do you counteract that?
Right. We have to use resources. And what I argue at the end of the book is that, you know, I'm not saying we don't take anything from nature, because we do. And we have an interrelationship with nature. There's a term for it, socioecology. It's this idea that social networks and environmental networks do coexist. We've always used nature to support life,
yeah.
Right? So how can we do that without wrecking the place? And we know that it can be done because societies have done it in the past. Current societies are doing it, you know, to varying degrees now. And it's just a matter of looking beyond the role of ourselves as individual consumers and the choices that we make and looking at the larger picture.
So what you're not arguing is that people should stop doing the green things like the reusable bags and the reusable cups and any of that. You're not arguing that. You're saying it just may not be enough.
But there are some, you know, quote unquote, green products that are really bad.
Let's talk about some of those. You talked about a few of them. Some of them include this label of organic food, and sometimes it's a little deceptive.
I would say that locally grown organic food environmentally is very sound. I looked also at globally grown organic. Increasingly, as big corporations take over the organic food industry, they are sourcing organic inputs from all over the world, developing countries primarily. So I ended up in Paraguay on an organic sugar plantation, which supplies a third of all the organic sugar consumed in the United States. This plantation is doing things like clearing trees, clearing native ecosystem to expand its organic cropland. This doesn't make environmental sense. It makes economic sense. And yes, they're not spraying the crops with chemicals, and that's better, but they're pulling apart these vital ecosystems that can't be replaced, at least not anytime soon. Biofuels, for example, the government mandates consumption of biofuels in this country, in Europe, in parts of China, and in many other countries around the globe. It's increasingly popular because it's seen as a green, renewable energy. What's happening in places like Indonesian Borneo, where I went and spent some time in the rainforest in some indigenous villages, is that they are clear-cutting one of the last large remaining rainforests on the planet to grow crops for biofuels. Where I was the last remaining viable habitat for the orangutan.
You actually visited one farm that you considered kind of beyond organic, the Morse Pitts Windfall Farms in New York, and he was really struggling.
Yeah.
So talk to us about the broader implications of that.
This is the other side of the economics of organic. The small local farmer is hailed as the hero of this wave of environmentalism and the transformation of the food system. And what I found is that so many of these farmers have a really hard time making ends meet, even though they charge quite a bit of money for the produce that they make, but their costs are so high and there's such a dearth of infrastructure for them.
These independent, quasi-independent agencies that certify, they also have these huge corporations like Cargill and Archer Daniel Midland on the board. Did you have a sense that that is just compromising their standards?
Corporations were founding members, and it was a partnership that they entered into with the World Wildlife Fund. And there are some other environmental groups that participate. One of the plantations I visited where this plantation company is illegally deforesting, they're making they're refining palm oil, which they sell to a company called Wilmar, which is partially owned by Archer Daniels Midland. So you have this dispossession of native indigenous communities, absolutely wiping out of this rainforest and burning the trees once they've been cut down. And that kind of forest clearance has made Indonesia the third largest CO2 emitter globally. This is a country without developed industries. It trails only the U.S. and China in its CO2 emissions because of all the deforestation.
You are not somebody who says more regulation is really going to help. You address the socially responsible business kind of approach, that what you even call the triple bottom line. And it sounded like you didn't have a lot of faith in it.
I don't, because I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding of the economic system. There's a critique in this. It's often referred to as natural capitalism or green capitalism. Natural capitalism says, well, we need the government to come in. So natural capitalism is an interpretation of capitalism that says you can clean up the environment, you can green your business, and all of this will save you money, make your enterprise more efficient, and it will win over customers. And in this economic system, because it does have to grow, that energy goes back into expanding the business and intensifying, you know, making new markets and further intensifying consumption. So it's not like you retire those savings. So when Walmart replaces its truck fleet with more fuel efficient vehicles, it's not like the greenhouse gases that aren't being made are just put away. Walmart opens another store and another store and another store.
Let's talk about ecological housing units that you saw in Europe. You seemed inspired by them.
You know, I look at what's not working, but I also look at what's working. I went to Germany to the town of Freiburg, which is referred to often by people as an eco-village, housing a total of 15,000 people. They've been around for over a dozen years, and so they have this track record. You know, is it comfortable, weird? You know, is it like culturally kind of alienating? And what I found was that it was very accessible, and it's different for different people, of course.
What is it about it that works?
What works is that they've built buildings using passive house methods, which is a super insulated building method and very well-made components that hold as much energy. In Germany, about 3/4 of all CO2 emissions come from heating of the building emissions. So it's really important to have really well-insulated structures. There's also buildings in this neighborhood that actually produce more energy than they use. They all have solar panels as their roofs. And something that the German government is doing is they have this thing which is called the feed-in tariff. How it works is regular people can put solar panels on their house. They plug those solar panels into the grid, and the utility is obliged to buy power from them for 20 years at double the going rate. So that means that individuals can pay off their solar panels in 7 to 8 years, and then they get a dozen years of pure profit. So it becomes financially doable for them, because with renewable energy, all the costs are up front. And with coal, we get to spread those costs out over time. And it's not something that the government is paying for in Germany. All the ratepayers chip in, so everyone's participating. I'm not totally opposed to regulation. I think that everything kind of plays a role, but there has to be ways that we use all the different, you know, mechanisms that we have in ways that make the most sense.
Okay, and now let's end with transportation. And one of the things that you're critical of is the carbon offset. First of all, talk about what the carbon offset is and what Sure. your considerations are. Where do we go from here?
So carbon offsetting is available to regular consumers. It's a voluntary product that we can buy. When you get an airplane ticket, say, there's often now an option on the website to say, you know, offset my carbon from this flight and pay $10 or $15 extra. And that money goes to a company that then partners with nonprofits typically on the ground in places most often in developing countries. China and India are the number one sites of carbon offset projects. I went to India, where a quarter of all the world's offsetting projects are being carried out. And what I found is that, you know, it sounds great. I emitted this carbon. I paid this money. Now my conscience is clear. Except it doesn't quite work like that. Carbon can only be neutralized over time. So if you plant a tree, it's not until the full lifespan of that tree is over that carbon has been absorbed. That might take 100 years. And clearly we need carbon to be reduced now. And then there are other issues with carbon offsetting, like do the projects actually get carried out at all? There can be really unintended consequences. One of the places I went to was a renewable energy plant that was supposed to run on crop wastes. And what was happening is that it's in this very poor farming region, and people are cutting down trees to sell to the plant to earn extra money. There's all kinds of possible snags that are really hard to anticipate when you're sitting at your computer and you want to do the right thing. What we need to do, I think, is to really not accept an oversimplification of the situation we're in and why we're here. From what I saw on the ground, carbon offsetting, it can't take carbon out of the atmosphere.
Tell us how we should approach this now.
We need to practice our environmentalism in a range of ways, not just through what we buy. Part of that environmentalism, the way that we can practice it is by educating ourselves. I think if we can expand environmentalism to include the social, we see environmental crisis so in such a compartmentalized way. And I think if we can start to open that up and understand the connections between the social, the economic, and the environmental, we can really start making some progress that is based on hope and not based on false hope.
Thank you, Heather Rogers. The book is called Green Gone Wrong, How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution. Thank
Maria,
you so much.
Thank you.
This is them in the broken heart, feel the open palm, part of my flowing thoughts, my departure from the norm, the past is more warm, war torn from the marching of your armies and the dropping of your bombs. The walking on the waters now, stomping on the pond. The ripples not wave. You can't be peaceful with a pistol in your face. You can't beat the people, so you picking on their place. I jump to defend, I'm waged with a page. My pen's mightier than them, and I got missiles on the stage. It's couches for the cowards, it stretches for the brave. And I happily lay upon the bed that I have made. Like housekeep, sheets and pillowcase. But I don't sleep, dreams is keeping me away. They went up thinking that they had never touched the ground.
And that is what we have for the Friday morning radio zine, this wonderful July 3rd. Wanted to thank you, KABU members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. We will be standing by here for the Blues Festival to come on. They are in the wings down at the Waterfront Park. And until we get to the noontime hour, we're going to listen to a little Janis Joplin to spark your interest for the blues.
She's looking good to me right now.
We're gonna play a little rock and roll right now. We're gonna start with Richard. Take it, baby.